All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with verses 12 and 13. I myself, Koheleth, had been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I had set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with it. And then they wouldn't have ended the sentence with a preposition if they'd actually translated the Hebrew with it, as it closes there at the end of the verse. So we stop here, I think, at about point 18. Given these advantages here, Solomon set about on a quest to understand and explain life. He searched for meaning in the disciplines with which he was familiar, but found nothing that satisfied him. 19, in the verses that follow, we may observe the following pattern. A statement of the vain nature of external attempts to find meaning in life in verses 13 and 14. A proverb that is quoted in support of that contention in verse 15. An explanation that internal attempts to make sense of life are equally vain. Now, these are the only two approaches you can use, by the way, are internal or external attempts. And another proverb quoted in support, which is in verse 18. 20, the Hebrew phrase, I gave my heart, New American Standard, I set my mind, is an idiom that simply means to devote one's mental faculties to something, to make it a priority. And in that sense, I believe it was priority number one. Maybe to make it a little stronger, that this was a devotion for Solomon at that point. And Daniel chapter 10 uses a similar idea. And this is in the Hebrew portion of Daniel. Of course, the first portion of the book is written in Aramaic there. But Daniel chapter 10, verse 12. Then this is when the angel appears to him. And behold, a hand touched me, and he stood upright. And then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this. And it's the same idea, to give your heart to it is to fully devote yourself to figuring something out. Now, Daniel was trying to figure out prophecy, as we know. But from the first time you set yourself on this, and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard. And I have come in response to your words. And so Daniel had devoted himself to figuring certain things out. Daniel, as we know from our study of the book, was fascinated with the whole concept of the Antichrist. This was a character that really fascinated him. He didn't have, obviously he was never going to see Antichrist and all that, but Daniel, outside of the book of Revelation, was given more insight and more prophecy and more revelation about Antichrist than any other person in the Bible. And I think this was an area of fascination for Daniel, an area of study, something he devoted himself to, and he wanted an explanation of how this thing could happen and what this all was going to be, and particularly as it related to Antichrist. And so because he humbled himself and he really devoted himself to it, God answered his prayers. Oh, surprise, surprise. You humble yourself before God, devote yourself to seeking the truth, and God gives you the truth. Yeah, absolutely. Well, 21, the Hebrew noun lave here can refer to the internal organ. It's not used much to refer only to the internal organ, but it can refer to that, and we know, you know, the heart is the pump that sort of makes you go. But however, it is used in an abstract sense to denote the totality of man's inner or immaterial nature. And again, you can see the doctrine of the heart. I'm convinced that the heart refers to the current real you. We know the soul is the real you in the sense of the immaterial, invisible part of you. But when we talk about things like the phrase, he had a change of heart, we're talking about the real you, your core beliefs, structure, and system that makes you who you are. And we know that you're who you are. You are what you believe. You are what you think. You're not who you think you are. You are what you think. And if your thinking is flawed, you're flawed. Just as it's true of all of us. So it's the current you, which the totality of the doctrine and everything you've got, your unique personality and all that makes you you. And so to give your heart to something is to throw yourself into it, we might say, to devote yourself to it. 22, it should generally be understood to refer to the core being. And I would also add to this term here, the current core being, because you can change. And we see that in the phrase like change of heart. And you see the doctrine of the heart, because I tried to deal with a lot of those phrases. I haven't looked at it in a while, and it could probably be updated. But a lot of phrases like follow your heart. What's that mean? We use these terms without, you know, sometimes without thinking about what they mean. Follow your heart means be yourself and go for it. But now Solomon's going to tell people, follow your heart. But also realize God's going to judge you. Oh, well. That will moderate it a little bit, how much you follow your heart, if you got any sense. Okay, maybe my heart's leading me, you know, you better stop and ask, could my heart be leading me in the wrong direction? Just because it's in your heart doesn't make it right. We all have to know that. We've all had times, I've ended up with egg on my face, I was so sure I had it all together and had it all right, and I knew in my heart I was right. And guess what? I was wrong. So, and Solomon will tell him later, follow your heart. Youth and childhood are fleeting. Enjoy yourself. But know that God will judge you. Be aware of that. So the thoughts, the beliefs, the priorities that make the person who he or she is. And again, I would say again, the current you is probably the best definition I've come up with. Because that can change. 23, the term is used to refer to many of the personality functions of mankind. He was wounded in his heart. It means his feelings were hurt. So it refers to emotions at some level. His heart smote him. You got to love the King James. What's that mean? That's referring to the conscience. Your conscience bothered you. The emotions, the thoughts, the will, and you can add a lot of things to this. The conscience, various other functions are described by the term heart. And David, this is one I was thinking of, when he cut off the edge of King Saul's robe and he lifted his hand against God's anointed. He didn't do anything real bad. He could have killed him. He was in the cave with him. And he could have killed him. But he actually had such norms and standards, such high understanding of doctrine, he was afraid to even lift his hand against God's authority. And when he did it, his conscience got him and took him for a ride through Guilty Park. And he was guilty. He should have not done what he did. And he did a minor thing. This was a very minor thing. Just cut off the edge of the robe to let Saul know, hey, I was in that cave. I could have killed you. And I didn't. But God said, no, I don't want you doing it. You don't lift your hand against an authority like that. You got to recognize and respect the chain of command. And David knew it. See, he knew this, and his standards were right. He should have felt guilty, and he did. Well, one aspect or another may be the dominant meaning in any given passage. The interpreter should seek to be clear about what aspect of the inner life is in view. And here, again, it's the mind or thinking, and I think also the idea of a wholehearted devotion to the task. I gave my heart means I fully devoted myself to it. And clearly, he's going to do a mental exploration. He's not doing a exploration of his conscience or an exploration of emotions. Although emotions will factor into this, because he's going to tell you how he feels about all of this. And as he'll say, chapter 2, verse 10, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I see it, I want it, I got it. That's a good life, isn't it? Approach life that way. I see it, I want it, I got it, it's mine. That's going to be my new motto. I see it, I want it, I got it, it's mine. And then guess what? No, it's not really. I was kidding, of course. That will be my motto. And I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. So emotionally, what was satisfying to me, I gave in to myself. And I did what I wanted. And some people think that will make them happy. I'll do it my way, you know, Sinatra. I'll do it my way and I'll be happy. Regrets? I've had a few. You're going to have a few more too if you do it your way. You better figure that out. And I think every one of us could stand up. We could do testimony time. All right, did you do it your way? Tell us how, and tell us how it worked out for you. And, yeah, I did, and it was miserable. And so, but the idea here is Solomon says, look, I gave my heart anything I wanted. And my heart was pleased. So he's telling you about emotionally how he felt. I'm very satisfied with all this. I see it, I want it, I got it, it's mine, I'm happy. I will add that to the whole equation. Well, 25, the two infinitive constructs that follow, both with a prefix lamed, set forth the purpose or intention of the younger Solomon with respect to his pursuit of wisdom. And I try to, throughout my notes, I've tried to, when I'm going to refer to the younger Solomon, I'll try to call him Koheleth every time. If I mess up, don't shoot me. But I'll try to, when I use Koheleth, I'm talking about the younger Solomon that's doing all this, or had done it, or had drawn these conclusions. See, you have several younger Solomons. You got the younger Solomon who was seeking and searching, who wasn't, in a sense, happy or contented. Then you got the younger Solomon who decided to do this. Then you got the Solomon that was in the middle of this experiment. Then you got the Solomon at the end of it that's drawing conclusions. And then, of course, you got the older, much wiser Solomon down here down the road writing the book. You're dealing with Solomon at a number of times in his life. 26, the first infinitive is used extensively in the Old Testament. Has the nuance of carefully seeking or searching out something. It has the idea of diligence and the care that one takes to get to the root of a matter. For instance, it's used in Genesis 9:5. There in the famous or infamous capital punishment passage, which all the fundies and a lot of fundies and liberals reject. Oh, everybody at some level rejects it. Not everybody, but a lot of people reject this because they don't like the idea of capital punishment. 9:5, surely I will require, and this is the word he uses here, your lifeblood. In other words, God says, I'm going to do diligence and search this stuff out. I'm going to hold people responsible for their stuff. At some level, you have to have some sense of confidence in God that if he says he's going to do it, he's going to do it. Now, it may look like on the surface people get away with murder, OJ, but Mr. Subliminal there. The idea is God will take care of this. And from what I've seen, let's say for the fact, just for the sake of the argument, let's say OJ did it. How's his life been since then? I just saw again in the paper the other day, I didn't even read the article, I just saw he was on there and in more trouble apparently. Will he get away with murder if he did it? I really don't know if he did it or not. But if he did it, will he get away with it? No, God will catch up to him. And you got to have confidence in that. That God will take care of certain things. You see, some people lose confidence in the fact that God will handle it. They figure, if I can't, I got to handle it. No, you don't. God will handle it. Leave it in God's hands at a certain level. This is called, a new concept, faith rest. We'll leave it to God and let him sort it out. I will require your lifeblood from every beast. I will require it from every man and from every man's brother. I will require the life of man. And again, the idea is to search it out, to do due diligence with the issue. God doesn't miss these sorts of things. The problem, I think, with a lot of us is God doesn't move as fast as we think he ought to. And so if God's not moving as fast as we think he should, well, he must be wrong. But we won't come out and say, I think God's wrong, because that wouldn't be spiritual, right? At least Solomon will flat out blame God. I like that. Blame God. He doesn't blame David. He doesn't blame the people around him. He blames God for this grievous task that he's got. 27 here, the second infinitive is used far less often. It is most notably used for the activity of the spies as they searched out the land of Canaan. Numbers chapter 13, Numbers 13:2. And this is another one of the things I'd really love to do, rapture permitting, is to go back and study the Exodus and all the stuff that was going on there among these negative believers and all that Moses had to put up with. I mean, that to me is fascinating. And the stupidity and the way they tested God and the way they wouldn't faith rest things and the way they sought to usurp authority and all that and all the things they did. And God put up with him, for a while. He put up with him. He bore with him, graced him out. But then at a point, of course, he finally just writes the whole generation off and says, I'm going to kill you all. Every one of you from 40 years up, you're dead. You're going to die in the wilderness. You're never going to see the promised land. Your children are going to see it, but you won't. And all the things that went on with this group. And I mean, they are a mental bunch of basket cases. I mean, you study this, and I mean, these people are mental, fully. Because they're negative. They're believers, but many of them are believers, but they're negative. They don't want to do it God's way. They won't commit to it and stick with it. And that makes for a miserable believer in the long run. So, again, that's just something I don't know. Maybe Exodus will be the next book. I don't know. We've done Genesis. It's been a long time ago. I could probably bring it up to snuff, but I don't really want to redo 50 chapters, frankly. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send out for yourself men so they may spy out." The idea here, of course, is to reconnoiter the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. And, of course, you know what that negative generation said, don't they? Don't you? They said, "No, you won't." They called God a liar, essentially. Now, they won't step up and say, "God, you're a liar." But in their hearts, they didn't believe God. They didn't trust God. They didn't trust God to take care of them, even though he'd taken care of them all this time. I mean, these are the people that saw the parting of the Red Sea. And if you ever get a chance, if you want to go to Egypt, I guess, go down there on the Sinai Peninsula and look across the Gulf of Aqaba there and see if you can see the other side over into Arabia, Saudi Arabia. It's some distance. And they'd seen this parted. They'd seen all Pharaoh's armies killed. They had literally walked out of Egypt with the wealth of Egypt in their pockets. God told them, "Just go up to your Egyptian neighbor and tell him you want some blessing." And they gave it to him. "I want some wealth." "Okay, go." They were just so ready to get rid of the Jews by then. They just said, "Go." They'd seen all this. They'd seen the manna. They'd been fed in the middle of the desert. They had a pillar of cloud by day to shield them from the sun. They had a pillar of fire by night. They'd seen these manifestations of God. And yet they wouldn't believe. They'd seen it, face to face, seen it over all these years, and still wouldn't believe. That to me is just a fascinating study in negative volition. Maybe not edifying, but fascinating. So send them out to spy out the land of Canaan. It's also used in verse 16. These are the names of the men whom Moses sent to spy out. But Moses called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Joshua. Which is a derivative, as you probably know, you can probably tell off of Yeshua, has the idea of salvation, is the kind of the root meaning of the word, of wholeness. And then verse 17, Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan. So roughly about 2 million Jews. How many of them get into the promised land? None of them. Their children do. Oh, I'll take that back, too. Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, whose name means dog. Caleb the dog and Joshua, they get in, and the rest of them die in the wilderness. Little by little, God kills them off in different ways. "You're negative, fine. I won't kill you all quickly." Now, I could do that, but I'm going to torture you to death. I'm going to make you wander around in the wilderness. Some of you will die with these poison asps will come in and kill you, coral snakes, let's say. And you get this fiery bite, and then you slowly die. And then God, even in the midst of all of this, you see grace still extended to these people. In the midst of all this, he says, now I'll tell you what, anybody that's been bitten by this snake, I want you to make this bronze serpent and you put it up on a pole. And anybody that looks at it will live. You know, you can see the people out there. "Son, I've been bit by the snake." "Dad, I hear that all you got to do is go to this pole and look at it." "Nah, son, I'm dying. I'm dead. It's over for me." "But Dad, you can go look at the snake and live." "No, I don't believe it." "There it is. I don't believe it." Just as the same way, and of course this is designed to be a type of Christ, obviously, and a type of salvation, and a type of the cross. What do you believe for salvation? "I believe in a crucified Jew." "Oh, that seems odd." "How are you getting to heaven?" "Well, I believe in a crucified, resurrected Jew, to be more obvious, but... did you get saved?" "Yeah, I looked at the bronze snake on the pole. And I'm alive, even though the snakes bit me." That'd be a testimony, wouldn't it? But then, you know, if you're negative, ultimately God's going to kill you some other way. Well, the joys of negative volition, such as they are. Well, 28, although the terms might appear to be synonymous, the semantic difference would seem to be between the depth of the search and the width of it, would be what I would say, is that... The first one there, which I believe is Darash, means to be diligent to really probe the depths of a matter. And the second one would be a wider scope, to probe the extent of a matter, we might say. Or the various nuances out there of something. Well, 29, Solomon would have carefully examined all the things that were part of the Jewish life and tradition. Further, he expanded his search to other places and nations. So he would have searched the Jewish wisdom literature, of course, and the wisdom of the sages and the ages. And then he would have said, well, maybe the answer doesn't lie in Israel. Maybe the answer lies in somewhere else. And he would have checked somewhere else. Maybe the answer's in Egypt. Maybe the answer's in the Far East, as Alexander seemed to think. Alexander's a good example of somebody that never was satisfied. The movie, if you've seen it, is a pretty good accurate rendition of his life and how he died and all that. But he wanted to conquer the world. He had this prophecy, that he was going to rule the world. And, of course, we believe that he will. So 30, in that regard, his extensive contacts and interactions with other cultures would have allowed him to acquire information that might not be readily available to the average person. For instance, you and I mean, how much do you really know about French culture? Well, if you go immerse yourself in it, you'll find out about it. Or the Spanish culture, or the Portuguese culture, or pick any culture, the German culture, the Russian culture, the Somalian culture. How much do you really know about it? Well, I'd have to say for most of us, we'd probably admit, well, our knowledge is limited based on the fact that we're somewhat isolated from these cultures. Solomon wasn't isolated. That's the beauty of his niche. They came to him. So he could readily interview the Queen of Sheba. Hey, how do you guys do it there? What do you think? What's your wisdom? This and that. Let me pick your brain. Now you got here's Solomon, the wisest guy on the planet, picking people's brains to find out, well, what do you know? What do you know? What do you know? And at the end of it all, of course, he didn't know much more than he did when he started, as it turns out. Other than he knew that, searching all this out wearied him to death, wore him out. He wore himself out in the middle of all this. That's another blessing you get in all of this. Not only do you die, you're going to wear yourself out doing it. So anyway, he would have had, again, all kinds of advantages that the normal person just doesn't have. And 31, the next term has also occasioned some discussion. Some seeing the prefix Baith as acting as a preposition, denoting the means by which Solomon conducts his investigation. Now that would be sort of the New American Standard translation. I did this by means of wisdom. I didn't abandon my roots, as we might say, as it were. And others here seeing it as a marker of the direct object. Wisdom being the object of search. In other words, I set my mind, and you would translate that, I set my mind to seek and explore wisdom. And what did he mean by wisdom? Well, then he's going to define that as concerning everything that's been done under the sun, assuming there's some wisdom out there to be had. With wisdom being the object of his search. Well, 32, a similar construction is used later, which is clearly used to indicate the means by which Solomon conducts his search into life. In chapter 2, verse 3, he said, I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely, and to take hold of insanity and foolishness. How are you going to do that? By drinking. That's how I'm going to do it. And so some have argued, well, Solomon was just a connoisseur of wine. He only drank the finest wines, and so therefore that's all he explored, and he never drank to excess. I would tend to disagree. I would say that anybody who's ever drank has drank to excess at least once in their life. Is Solomon's the lone exception to this? I don't think so. I don't think you're that wise. I think you're going to make these mistakes. It happens. So, verse two, chapter 2 there, verse 3, when he says, I did it with wine. And the idea here is it's got a prefix, bait, with wine, to show you the means by which he did it. And so I think that's the means here. I think also here, it's also used in 7:23 in a similar way. You got a similar construction there. And I tested all this with wisdom. And I said to myself, I will be wise. But it was far from me. At least he recognizes at some level, at certain points in his thinking, you see he's getting these breakthroughs. He's recognizing now my limitations. For all my wisdom, I don't have wisdom at some level. And I think he's recognizing at least subjectively that, well, even I've done all this, have I really become wise? Am I any wiser than I was, we might say. Oh, yeah. So in that regard, point 33, Solomon is indicating to his readers that he has not abandoned the, quote, wisdom tradition of Israel. He is pursuing his objectives according to the best and wisest method he knows. In that regard, he's kind of, you know, we might say he's like a doctor who's practicing medicine. We know he's practicing, but he probably has, you know, he's been educated, he's got skills, and he probably does things according to the best information available to him at that time. And just like Solomon says here, I'm doing this according to the best things I know. I'm not abandoning anything here. I'm not going to pursue this as, you know, first, I'm not going to pursue it superficially. He definitely makes that plain. And secondly, I'm not just going to foolishly abandon everything I know and chuck it all. I'm going to continue to pursue this according to the best traditions of wisdom I have and to what I know at this point. So 34, he simply does not accept what he has been told. He questions everything thoroughly. First rule of an exegete, question everything. You say, well, I know what this verse says. I've heard it 100 times. Well, you better look at it again if you're going to teach it. And you better make sure that it says what it says. Just because you've heard it says this 100 times doesn't make it so. But sometimes people say things so often it just gets accepted, it becomes dogma, whether it's true or not. I remember when I was first down here and I challenged the whole concept of the edification complex of the sacred cow. I'm going to take out an axe right in front of you and I'm going to slaughter your sacred cow. Watch. This will be fun. Blood's flying everywhere. And some people took me to task on it right away. How dare you question anything theme taught? How dare me, indeed. Well, I think the number one rule of an exegete is you have to think for yourself. And if you can't, well, then you're just going to parrot what you've been told all your life. I did that as a fundy. That's what I got out of, parroting what I'd been told. I said, hey, I've got to be able to study this out for myself. I've got to see what these verses really say. Well, guess what? The fundies had sadly misled me and badly misled me. And even in terms of doctrine over the years, I mean, I figured out certain things about verses that people clearly just haven't missed or whatever, for whatever reason. I mean, the modifications haven't been great. It hasn't, you know, I've had these great breakthroughs. No, and I don't know. But certain things I think have been really straightened out. So Solomon says, look, question everything thoroughly. Don't just assume you know because you think you know. Look at this. Look at it again. This is the approach of a tough-minded individual that will not be deterred from getting to the bottom of things. And this can be both a good quality and a dangerous quality. You have to recognize that. He's trying to get to the bottom of things that don't have a bottom in some ways. Well, that's a waste of your time and effort. So you have to know when to trust and when not to trust. When to think, when not to think. As he says, there's a time for everything. And so if you go through the verses as an exegete, you say, well, okay, the verse says what I've always been told. Fine, at least you've checked it out and you know, and you've confirmed it. That's what you've got to do. And I'll never forget the shock the first time I told Stuart that when he first got. He said, well, I know this is says, it's been taught for years. I said, how do you know? Have you done the verse? Have you looked at it for yourself? Well, but this is what we've always been taught, so... So what? I remember the shock in his voice. What? Question everything. And he said, you know, that was good advice. He said, I realize now, hey, absolutely. I've got to get to the bottom of it myself. Well, Solomon does that. And that's a good quality. And again, it can be dangerous, but this is a good quality to have. To not just accept everything you're told. Then you have to know when to just accept what you're told, that it, by faith it's true. You have to be able to figure this out as a believer. 35, the Hebrew term chokmah, a wisdom, is used to express a number of facets of the human experience. For instance, it is used of technical skill in Exodus 28:3. And as you know, in life, there are people that are technically proficient at certain things. I'm not. I mean, you know, I know people, those of you who know Joe Hinthorn, he's very proficient with electricity. I don't want to mess with it. There are people that are proficient at various things. They have the skill and the ability to handle it. Me, no. Exodus 28:3, you shall speak to all the skillful persons. That's the word, actually our word there, chokmah, for wisdom, for the wise person. But what's he talking about here? I want people whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom that they may make garments. Now, some people can sew and put things together and have an eye for color and all of that. Can you? Is that you? It's not me. And you have people are gifted in this area. And so the idea here is a technical skill. People are skilled in craftsmanship. It's Exodus 31:3 is where that one's used. Here's this guy, Bezalel. And I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom and in understanding and knowledge and in all kinds of craftsmanship to make artistic designs for work in gold and silver and in bronze. And there are carvers and engravers and artists that can do wonderful things. Is that you? It's not me. That can, you know, that have skill in this. And their craftsmanship is wonderful. I mean, you see, you know, they do different statues and different things. Okay. That's good. That's a part of wisdom. It's used also of tactics in warfare. Isaiah 10:13. This is another part of wisdom. If you find yourself in a battle, who do you want there? You want some general that says, I don't know, men, what do you think we ought to do? Or do you want somebody that understands tactics and all that? I see, Alexander, he was a great tactician. I mean, you go and study his battles against the Medes and the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire. And with far fewer men, he overwhelmed greater forces a number of times, not just once or twice. I mean, routed them. I mean, it'd be like a football game where two guys take on 11 and beat them. I mean, that's a tactician who understands things in warfare, that's who you'd want leading you, I would think. Should we take a vote on this? No, the general makes the decisions and you move on. And you're betting your life he's right. Isaiah 10:13 here. And it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Syria and the pomp of his haughtiness. For he said, by the power of my hand and my wisdom I did this. For I have understanding. I have removed the boundaries of peoples. I have plundered their treasures. Like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants. So his wisdom was, you know, his skill in warfare and his ability to beat his enemy, which is a great thing to have. And it's also used of administrative skills for those in authority. Deuteronomy 34:9. That's a part of wisdom, is to be able to administer things properly. So you can see this word kind of runs the gamut. You might think wisdom, and you might think, well, just wisdom literature or something. But it runs the gamut of things that people do. Deuteronomy 34:9. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom. For Moses had laid hands on him, and the sons of Israel listened to him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. And so Joshua is going to, what he's effectively going to administrate, also through God's leadership, of course, is the taking of Canaan. And he's going to administer and oversee that whole thing. And gets a word from God, okay, here's how you're going to take Jericho. What's the battle plan, Lord? Do I send you a force up front? Do I divide my forces? No, I want you to march around the city for 7 days and blow trumpets. Say what? No, this is the way I'm going to do it, seriously. And you're going to do this. And they never fired a shot, and the walls of Jericho fell outward. Jericho was a city set up on an elevated spot. And the walls all tumbled outwards and rolled down the hill. And the people knew they were dead at that point. Well, the walls of your fortifications gone. No way to get to them. No way to save them. And so, by the way, when you go in, there's this one hooker I want you to save. What? Yeah, and so Joshua administrated all this. And he did it just the way God wanted him to do. And when he didn't do it the way God wanted him to do it, guess what? God jammed him. And he suffered the consequences of it. It's also used in 2 Samuel 14:20. So there's a real wisdom in being able to administer an organization and all that entails. And being the guy sort of at the top where the buck stops here. You can't look to anybody else. If there's blame, you're going to have to blame Joshua in the case of, say, taking Canaan. 14:20, in order to change the appearance of things. Your servant Joab has done this, but my Lord is wise, like the wisdom of the angel of God, to know all that is in the earth. And here, this was Solomon, by the way, as he was beginning to take the kingdom. And so he had to be kind of careful. Obviously, you know, first when you're in charge, people are going to come out of the woodwork. Some people are going to come out against you. Some are going to try to suck up to you. And if you're going to administer things fairly and properly, you're going to have to be wise about it. You can't be suckered by people. There's a certain level at which wisdom shades into the idea of discernment too. The Hebrew word deen, judgment, which has the idea of discerning things. And if you're going to administer things, you better be discerning about things. Everybody's not what they appear to be on the surface. And you better be able to see below all that. And Solomon did. He saw, hey, this guy's manipulating this situation from over here. I see what he's doing. And yet, the only way he could have seen that was through his wisdom, through his discernment. Well, 36, true wisdom comes from God and leads to a fear of the Lord, which a lot of people today are just sadly lacking. They lack a real fear of God. They think they have it, but they don't. It is characterized by the positive concepts of shrewdness. That's practical wisdom. Again, why do we have to be shrewd? We're supposed to be shrewd as serpents, but harmless as doves. In other words, you better be discerning about life and about what comes at you and about what people are doing. It has the idea of prudence. We might call that cautious wisdom. See, the prudent man sees the danger and walks around the other way. He doesn't just blunder into stupidity. The prudent man looks ahead, we might say. That's cautious wisdom. Understanding, comprehending wisdom. We use these terms all the time. I understand. I comprehend it. I get it. And it also has the idea of insight, the depth of wisdom, to penetrate the weightier matters of doctrine and the truth. Some people are just superficial, and they're never going to get to the depths of the truth. There's wisdom, and then there's sound wisdom. That's even differentiated there in Proverbs. And, of course, discernment, discriminating wisdom. How to tell X from Y. How to know the differences. We use a phrase. He had a discerning palate. It means he could taste a wine, tell you which slope it was grown on, which grapes it was made out of, what year it came from, what vineyard. It's kind of an odd movie, but that movie, you know, Sideways was kind of funny in that regard. This guy had a great palate. He understood wine, and he could discern what he was drinking. Some people, you know, what's this? Ripple's fine with me. Well, okay. I'd rather drink something better. I really would. So discernment, that's a part of it. You've got to be able to see through people and not just be taken in by them. And you need to be shrewd. 37, Solomon applied all the disciplines with which he was familiar in order to investigate all that has been done under the heavens, which is designed to indicate the comprehensive nature of his research. 38, obviously no one can fully investigate every area of life, every endeavor in one lifetime. However, Solomon is indicating that he left no area available to him untouched. If it was available to him, he checked it out. He didn't say, well, I know about this, but I'm not going to see what's there. No, if I know about it, I'm going to check it out. And so he did. He checked out everything that was available to him. And at a certain level, you can, when I say no one can fully investigate everything, I mean, again, we're talking 3,000 years of human history by his time, roughly. And that's a lot to study, isn't it? Now we're going to try to do it with 6,000 years of human history. It's going to be twice as hard. But again, one of the things we might point out as we, you know, if we were to approach this today, let's say we're modern day Solomons and we're going to approach this, we could certainly take all that he's already told us and say, yep, I don't have to check out the natural cycles. I know they're still out there and they still work the same way. Nothing's changed in that regard. I recognize the generations are quick to forget. They don't think very long and hard about the past, and they forget it quickly and they move on. They're self-absorbed. That hasn't really materially changed, has it? And do I really have to do a lot of investigation to find out that young people are naive and can be really stupid and make bad decisions? No, that's pretty well a given. We pretty much know that. So certain things we wouldn't even have to check out. We would say, yeah, no, nothing's changed since Solomon's day on some regard. Do I have to check out, does everybody still die? No. Yep, they all still die. That's pretty much it. For all of our technology, we've extended life by what, 2 years? You know, Moses said the average age of a man when he wrote, circa 1400 BC or so, was 70 years. We haven't changed that materially. Still about the average age. So, again, he checks out everything as much as he can. As much as it's available to him, he checks it out. And he leaves no stone unturned at that point. So 39, the research must have been confined to historical persons and events. As seen in the Niphal Perfect, Asah, what has been done. And we would say historical, I mean, at least up until the time of his life. That's all he could check out. He's not worried about the future. All he can check out, as any person could, would be what's available to him in the past. And so he checks all that out. 40, this is the first of three times that Solomon uses the phrase under the heavens, which may only differ from the more common phrase under the sun in that it obliquely seems to bring God into the picture. And he sort of, it's weird, because even at the beginning of all of this, he kind of acknowledges God, maybe grudgingly, but he acknowledges him. And then as he goes on, he's not so grudging about God any longer as he goes through this. Say chapter 3, verse 1, he acknowledges, there is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven, which acknowledges that there's a certain divine timing to things. And what we have to try to do as shrewd believers, discerning believers, would be to figure out the divine timing of things. This is what Jesus chided his generation about. Oh, you people can read the signs in the sky, and you can't read the signs of the times? They should have known Messiah was present. Had they studied their Bible, had they studied Daniel, they should have been able to figure out that his claims to be Messiah fit every criteria that was known at that time. And not just Daniel, not just the chronological timing of it, but all the things that he did, all of his life. They should have been able to figure this out. They said, oh, red sky at night. You know, but they couldn't figure out Messiah when he was right in front of them. There are people like that out there. They think they're shrewd. They think they've got it together. And yet they can't see what's right before their very eyes. And they're completely undiscerning in that regard. Well, he at least acknowledges that there's a timing of God and God's hands behind all this. Now, what you got to figure out is, what is the timing and what am I supposed to be doing? And fit in, as it were, fulfill your destiny before God. God's got you here as you. Why? Why you? Why now? Why here? There's a reason for it. Obviously, we know from greater revelation in the New Testament, the local church is a body of Christ. It's an organic union among believers. That we all fit into the body, we're all part of the body, we all have a place, we all have a function. And to figure all that out and to fulfill all that, what you're supposed to be doing. And obviously it boils down to something pretty simple. You're supposed to be serving other believers. That is the goal of Christianity, love from a pure heart. So this obliquely at least seems, and he does acknowledge God's timing in all this stuff. Now, while it may bug him or be a source of irritation to him, he at least grudgingly acknowledges it's true. I see, okay, God's got time for all this. And I can't, and he at least acknowledges to his credit, he says, you know what, I can't figure out God's timing all the time. Well, that's a wise man. You can't figure out God's timing all the time. You just have to faith rest it and orient to it and wait for God to work things out at some level. And get the resolution for whatever it is you're facing before you. And that may not come overnight or over a week or over a month or over a year even. You may face long-term tests that aren't resolved for some time. But if you hang in there with the truth and apply the doctrine you know and trust God in it and be patient with it, God will work it out. I mean, if you don't have confidence in that, I don't know what to tell you. You got to have some confidence in that. So as he says there down towards verse 11 in chapter 3, he has made everything appropriate in its time. So I see out here, I see God behind all this. I acknowledge God's behind all of it. I don't like it. It bugs me, but he's behind it. And I can't do anything about it. And is that some of Solomon's level of frustration? And maybe a frustration we all face from time to time. God's in charge. Things would be better, Lord, if you'd let me be in charge. No, they wouldn't. I mean, deep down, I think we all know they wouldn't. And so God's in charge, and he has his plan, and he administrates it, and he delegates authority as he does. Starting, of course, with his son, the foremost delegated authority in the universe. He has given him a name above all names, and all this reputation and all this power. The Father has given to the Son to judge all men. And this all comes from God himself, and then he gives it to the Son. And we saw that, like, the chain of command sort of idea in the book of Revelation. Jesus Christ gave this revelation to an angel to give to his servant John, to give to his servants. And ultimately, now, later days, us. And so there was a line there by which God worked. And God works in orderly fashion. So you have to acknowledge that, you have to respect it, you have to orient to it. Even when it's not pleasant. You have to. I mean, or the option, you can maladjust. And that just brings discipline and judgment to your life. So, all right, God's got this plan. And sometimes, guess what? I'll acknowledge it, and probably you would too. Sometimes this plan rubs me the wrong way. I get enough of it sometimes. Just as Solomon did. But is rebelling against God the answer? I don't see it as the answer. In my normal, you know, waking mind when I'm sane and in fellowship. When I'm not in fellowship, there's no telling what I'll do. Just as there is with none of us. Or with all of us, rather. So 41, this desire to inspect all things, to research history, to examine every type of behavior and work, in order to understand things, does not leave any real place for faith. That's another whole issue here. Where's Solomon's faith in all this? He's a believer, we know that. I mean, he makes no secret of that. It relies on human abilities and rationalism. I want to see it, explain it, touch it, understand it, and figure it out. Well, guess what? Aren't there certain things we may not figure out? And this is another example of a good exegete is not going where you can't go. Okay, I think the verse teaches this, and you take it beyond what the verse actually says. That's not good. That's not good. You have to sometimes by faith say, and I had this happen a while back, it's been several years back. Somebody, you know, came and asked me several questions. You know, I got all these questions, I got hard questions. I said, okay. And so they asked me their hard questions, and I had to tell them, I don't know. And it just bugged them. Bugged them, got under their skin. Well, you wouldn't answer my question. It wasn't that I wouldn't, I didn't have the answer. I'll answer your questions if I have the answer. But you sometimes you just have to say, I don't have the answer. I don't know. Certain things I know. I can tell you what I know. But certain things I don't know. Well, I expect the pastor to have all the answers. Well, you better find another pastor then. Because I don't. And I don't think you're ever going to find one that does. But you just have to say, okay, well, I'll just have to rely on God and faith rest it. And God can use this guy to get me to maturity and all that. And he'll take care of me. And you just walk by faith. So again, Solomon's not walking by faith, though. He's checking everything out. It's empirical with him. I got to see it, touch it, taste it, understand it, feel it. I got to get to the bottom of it. So 42, although the term enion here is unique to Ecclesiastes and may be derived from several potential roots. Later rabbinic materials use the word in the sense of task, occupation, or situation. So the adjective ra here, evil or wicked, can be used in the sense of badly made. You know, it doesn't always have a moral connotation. You know, this is a poorly made garment. It can be used in the sense of little value. This isn't worth much. Or not beneficial. This isn't helpful. It is also used to refer to things that seem to function so as to cause distress, displeasure, or sorrow. I don't think it's a moral term here. And so the term, the phrase, is variously translated as grievous task, wearisome task, heavy burden, unhappy business, or evil distraction. And 45 here, one question that arises is why Solomon indicates that God has given this task to men when he previously stated that he had voluntarily assumed it. He says, I gave my heart to this. I devoted myself to this. Is this some acknowledgement that, oh, well, this is God's will for my life? And that answer is going to have to wait until Wednesday, so we will stop there and resume here with that. Thank you, Father, for the benefit of Bible doctrine. Thank you for the privilege of exploring the mind of Solomon. And pray as we approach your word and continue to think about these things that you will bless us with wisdom and insight, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.